Welcome to Peter's Podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. Today's episode is a round table. I invited three of my colleagues and good friends, and in one case, spouse, who've all had the opportunity to talk about the health benefits of meditation practice over time and various trainings. And I put us together around a table and we shared our thoughts. And we don't so much report on a bunch of data, although we do share some data findings that we've heard, but we more talk about how to use that kind of information from the point of view of a yoga practitioner and a yoga teacher. Like, what is it that we can feel comfortable saying, and how much do we really even care? And so we're pretty candid in this conversation. It's basically like four colleagues just over lunch, you know? So I hope that it's useful for you, and I'd love to hear your comments if you have any. Drop them in peterspodcast108@gmail.com. All right, so without any further ado, I have Wendy Newton, who you know from previous podcasts, Kristen Leal, who you know from previous podcasts, Kelly Udaly, who's a senior trainer at Ishta Yoga and a beloved teacher there, and myself. There are bios in the show notes if you'd like to know more about any of us, and here we go. Welcome, everybody. Yay. So we were just chatting, just to get the pump primed, about how hard it is to talk about this topic that I gave us to talk about today, which is health benefits of meditation, loosely speaking, or what in the world can science and medicine say about this practice that we do of yoga that leads to a different state of mind and has benefits that we all as yoga teachers experience, and we see other people experience them. So I thought it would be fun and perhaps aggravating and challenging to try to say anything real, because almost always when I talk about this topic, I spend 5 minutes at the front caveating that there's almost nothing that you can really say with any authority, despite the fact that many people are now trying or looking for a way to say. And the one maybe exception of that rule is with mindfulness-based stress reduction, where there's a protocol, you apply the protocol, and then you test for something. So then you have data. But, you know, Al and I just wrote a whole book on that's a terrible thing to call meditation. Just mindfulness-based stress reduction is all that meditation is, because it's such a rich practice. And I feel like people are being steered toward doing an MBSR program because that's what's in the newspaper. So, thoughts?
Discuss.
And I liked what you were just saying about trying to stick things to facts when you're trying to teach this.
Well,
Kelly,
one tension I feel is that, you know, if you look at the sort of ancient, or I don't even, the sort of yoga texts, it's like your knowledge comes from having this experience, right? And so you have the subjective experience that gives you some objective knowledge. Like, you know, meditate on the pole star and you will understand the physical universe or something. Mm-hmm. But then the way we, in our society, the way we so know things is more based on evidence-based practices. So there's this tension, I feel like, between those two ways of knowing, which is interesting. But back to also what you were talking about, Peter, there isn't a lot of research, at least from what I know, on the kinds of meditative practices that we're doing at Ishta, which to me seem more of an integrated experience where you're doing breath work, you're doing visualization, you're doing, like, you're doing all of these things maybe at once, and there isn't like a research paper that says, well, this is what's going to happen to your brain with this more integrated approach.
Right. And not just at Ishta, I mean, yoga in its history has had all of that additional stuff. You know, deities, mantras, visualization, kriyas, pranayama.
Do you know about the Resource Project?
What's the Resource Project?
Do you know about the Resource Project?
Do you tell?
It's, so this woman named Tanya Singer, who is at the Max Planck Institute in Germany, did this. It's one of the largest meditation studies that's been done. And they published, they started publishing their data, I want to say, in 2017. But it was this study with like 300 German adults, and it was a nine-month study. And she thought one of the main, and the people she's working with, one of the main issues of meditation research is that we don't know if different kinds of meditation have different effects. And it's a problem when research says meditation does this because there are so many different ways of meditating. So she created three different modules that explore different meditative styles. And what they found, of course, was that different ways of meditating have different effects on your brain and on social stress and on body awareness. So she's got a lot of data, actually, and it's fascinating. It's not all what you would think.
Very
so,
cool.
Yeah.
How do you usually frame the issue, Kristen?
I think there's that saying, scientists are trying to photograph it, mystics are trying to feel it. So however you want to come to it, I think is valid, right? But these days people like data. And I feel like sometimes we're in the position of trying to convince people why they should do these more meditative practices. And so it's nice to have some data. And I think that what we do know, what I have come to understand, that the brain is almost like a muscle, right? So the more you use it and the different ways you use it, it'll begin to build, so to speak, in those areas, making it more available to you. So I think this study is the one that I saw with talking about visualization, you know, or mantra, reciting mantra, or loving kindness meditation. Those would start building up the areas for visualization or for mantra, for sound, or for auditory processing, or for loving kindness, for compassion, because neurons that fire together begin to wire together. So if you do an action repeatedly, you know, your brain is just primed for that action. It's more available. It's more efficient groove that's formed. Just like if you're priming your brain with, I'm not good enough, I'm not good enough, I'm not good enough, eventually that becomes your go-to efficient groove. Mm-hmm. You don't have to give it a lot of thought. So these techniques are just ways of forming better grooves, more efficient, more life-sustaining, more balanced grooves. I think sometimes that's enough for me. I don't know if it's enough for the students, but it feels like enough for me, because that's my embodied experience of these things, that the more I can step outside of my own brain and observe it, the less pulled I am by it, the more I'm not a master of it, but I'm at least not its servant at all times.
I kind of feel the same way. I see myself as kind of being like in between worlds a little bit, and I can translate, but I don't like to be, I don't like to rely on studies or outcomes or proofs or those kinds of things as like a rallying cry to people, even students in particular, even if they are those type of students, because I often feel like the real, you know, proof of the pudding is in the tasting. And so that anecdotal evidence of like, did you do the practice? Did you do it consistently? Are you building those grooves? Are you deepening those grooves? And what are you seeing? I like to pull out the evidence that's anecdotal in them. Like, what are you seeing? What changes have you come across in yourself? Have you noticed that your fuse is getting shorter or longer? Have you noticed, different feelings arising relationally in your life with people? And you know what I mean? And just trying to make for them those connections, sort of pointing them back to that. And also to do a little bit more like processing in the room of their experiences, like in the moment of teaching, like, you know, do this experience and then let's talk about what that was. Because I think it helps to make that cognitive connection for people, rather than having to sort of indulge, and this is purely for me, to indulge their bias towards studies. And that being said, I think there are some amazing scientists doing some amazing studies, and we can use those. Like, it's just not my
thing. Yeah, there was a guy who presented at the last yoga and science conference who is the research director at Kripalu. I think his name is Satbir Khalsa. And he said a huge focus of the research that he's doing is to get enough data together to present a case for why yoga should be in schools.
Yeah.
Because he feels like that is the great equalizer. Now it's something that wealthier people can afford to do.
Yep.
And poorer people either don't even know about it, or they can't afford it. So he said, if we can make it something that it's in all schools, then everyone can benefit from yoga. So that's a noble mission, I think, for why you would do data collection, because he said nobody's going to take it otherwise,
right,
in the school setting.
There's only certain things you can see in data, though. There's, you know, the common fMRIs, you know, scans will show different activity where there's more glucose uptake, and mm-hmm. those things are very interesting. But the things you're talking about, Wendy, are not quantifiable. They're your own reported experience of how it's touching your relationships with yourself, with your partner, with others. And those are really hard to get data points on.
Yeah.
Impossible to get data points on.
Yeah.
But if it helps to open the doors to teaching these things in a less, in a more kind of secular setting, then that's great. But it's not going to take us all the way there to say, oh, and this is why I'm less of a jerk. if you look on this MRI, my jerk center is not lighting up. I think it's great if it helps it get into more accepted by people, or into school systems, or into businesses, or these are noble, wonderful.
Yeah.
The more it gets out there, the better for all of us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there are certain things that the reported experience of how it's touched your life.
Yeah.
These things are not seen on an MRI.
Yeah.
It's true. But you know, there's also, people present with things, and it could be emotional, it could be mental, it could be physical. Like, we were down at the beach with Peter's family, and our brother-in-law he's been experiencing high blood pressure. So he's a surgeon. So he was walking around with a monitor, and we did an experiment. We all meditated to see if we could lower our blood pressure.
Just doing an Apa Japa kind of thing.
Yeah. Did you lead it? I can't remember.
Yeah. Just hands breathing in one side out the other.
And, I'm proud to say mine came down the most.
You're such a good meditator.
Did you win the prize?
Yes. But his did not. But, that kind of thing, first of all, I have a lot more experience than him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
He has less experience, and he does have high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
But it was enough, I think, for him to look at that and say, he's a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
To look at that and say, okay, well, maybe I should learn how to meditate.
Mm-hmm.
you know,
three out of
I
four
can't,
of these people's blood pressure came
went
down.
Yeah. So, you know, that's it's still anecdotal. I don't know how you would, that's like
and a, plus he was
it's
skeptical.
Like, so. He's a skeptic and yeah. He's a scientist and there's four of us and it doesn't prove anything. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, something.
But there are studies about it of reducing
blood pressure. Yeah.
Blood pressure.
It's one of the ones where
it's one of the
there
really
is some evidence.
Yeah, and that is easy to
transcendental meditation. That's,
yeah, yeah, and yeah. Even the mindfulness, the 8-week course. You know that is something that you can have, kind of, before and after large group repeated, peer reviewed, published studies that people that are desiring that kind of evidence-based work.
Let's back up for just a second. I started by saying I'd start with a 5-minute caveat, and we just did 10. But because I think it's really important, because anything we say after this should have that caveat behind it. But Kelly, maybe you can talk about, like, for anybody who isn't so familiar with this whole field, like, what are the areas, and we can all have a crack at this, but what are the areas that we think about having a benefit? Like, what are the benefits of meditation? Like, how do you phrase that?
That
we brought
meditation,
notes so we can cheat.
Well, that meditation cannot, as far as we know, cure or prevent disease, but it can certainly help to reduce some symptoms and provide palliative care in many instances, like with people who are undergoing cancer treatment and things like that. So that would be one frame that I would put on it. And that, what do I remember? That there does seem to be some evidence that the meditation may reduce some symptoms of menopause, that it may help lower blood pressure. And that the studies I remember are about transcendental meditation and in terms of blood pressure.
Because they did a lot of research too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, and then we haven't even gotten into like all the issues with meditation research. Is there bias? And all, you know, all of that, you know.
And who has the money is the one that does the research, you know, and, you know.
One of the frames, that was a good word to use, one of the frames I think about is the that relaxation response component, which any repeated activity that you try to focus on brings about this shift between a sympathetic response and a parasympathetic response. So that classic, we're under stress all the time, and we have this way of breaking that by using certain kinds of meditation, like you were saying, certain meditations. You know, I think that's in some ways, I feel like that's at the root of so much of the health benefits of meditation.
Right.
That's how I learned it in the Ishta training, and I kind of stick by it. I mean, at the most, if you boil it down, put your attention on one spot and let everything else go that comes up, it really works. You know, I mean, it does that. It's the mechanism by which that retraining starts to happen. And then, you know, the studies could look at, you know, I feel like it's just so complex because we are such a complex system, you know? And if you do the same meditation in 10 different people and the same level of expertise and the same level of everything, you might see 10 different physiological outcomes slightly different because that's what was needing repair. You know, that's to me the biggest issue with breaking it down along those Western sort of categorical lines with that benchmarking and outcome is that it doesn't lend itself that easily to that.
Well, it wasn't designed to cure disease. It was designed for, you know, transformation of your life.
Exactly.
Just that.
So we're trying.
Yes. Just pretty all
you know.
Yeah. But then, and you mentioned fMRI. So this is a neuroplasticity question often, right? So it's like changing patterns of how our brain connects up. And that gets often into the like structure of the brain and the parts of the brain and what are those parts of the brain for, and can we shortchange the like observation to amygdala connection, right? The like everything I see makes me fearful, and get more of the part of the brain that is assessing and clarifying, and have that become more dominant, right? And fMRI studies are showing potential demonstrations of that kind of shift.
Yeah, most of the fMRI studies I've seen are on, they like to put Buddhist monks in those machines. and so they're testing really those types of meditations for the majority of what I've been able to see. And I obviously have not seen everything. That's really what they're looking at as what lights up, what is being used, what is being quieted.
And fMRI is literally a map of how much blood flow is in a part of the brain. Mm-hmm. And then so they give a situation and then watch for changes in the blood flow.
Right. But I think what becomes more interesting, and what I think that I'm seeing in the medical world or the study of medicine, is the integrative approach is starting to be more popular or studied or accepted, or all three of those maybe, but to look at not just what's happening in the brain, but how is this affecting your immune response? How is your digestive stuff affecting your brain, the bacteria in your gut? How is that affecting what is happening in your immune response and in your neurological response to things? So that's, like Wendy Thanks said, it great, yeah, but very hard to study because everyone's looking through their own little lens to get the data.
Right.
And it's very hard to then put all of that together with your own experience of how it's touching your life, like Kelly said, like, is this transforming your life? And put all these data points together to make a cohesive view of it, which it's just not going to happen.
There's something about the information about the brain and what parts of the brain are being activated or deactivated is fascinating, but it doesn't help a practitioner trying to just figure out how to meditate. It's not like I can say, okay, mediolateral prefrontal cortex, turn on. You know, it's like, it's not helpful.
Wait, you can't do that?
Good morning.
Yeah.
So there isn't necessarily a language that translates that, you know, this brain stuff to, like, what is actually...
Yeah.
But I have to say that
will happen.
I have to say that it's... For some reason, though, when you say, you know, prefrontal cortex to someone, sometimes it gets them on board to, well, maybe I should do this meditation thing. The people that have not drank the Kool-Aid already on this. And if you're not talking to a yogi or a teacher trainer, if you're talking to your boyfriend or you're talking to someone who's not in that world, sometimes if you say, well, if you're looking at the study that came out of Boston in 2011, and it looks at, you know, the left prefrontal cortex becomes persistently more active, and they see that in people that show optimism and people that have a higher vagal tone, and that sometimes convinces them to just sit their butt down and at least enter into the stream of meditation.
That's a really interesting point. So it's almost like a strategy is not to try to put an individual's experience and the research together too carefully, but to present the fact that there's all this research is showing interesting things, and that's why you should meditate. You know, I mean, in my thinking, like you said, it's good enough for me earlier when you were talking about it, and you said it's about self, Kelly said it's about, you know, changing your life and whatnot. And I feel like that is a good enough reason, you know, and we're all doing that. We're all looking for ways to transform our lives, to find more happiness, to make things work better, you know, to have a longer fuse when we're in interactions with people and things like that. And so we just need a bit of belief that this could be a way to get that. And so it's not like you can make a promise, you know, if you do this, you'll get fMRI results of X, and then you will have a fuse that is this much longer when you're interacting with your significant other.
Yeah.
But, yeah. It's,
but if it gets them to start.
To start, and then in the
and
doing of
it. And once they taste
it,
I think like Wendy was saying, I heard it first from Al, I don't know if it originated from Alan Finger, but you can tell someone about sugar. It's in this food, it tastes like this, it's granular, it hits this part of your tongue, you know, you can try, but best just to give them the sugar and let them taste it and have their experience of it. So whatever convinces them to at least
taste
to taste it
to experience.
And to experience it, and then let the experience then help them keep the consistency of the practice. That's the only difficult part about any of these practices. So you actually have to do them. That is the only challenge.
And it's not a pill. It takes time.
It takes time.
That's,
it's subtle.
That's the bigger challenge for me, of getting people convinced. Yeah.
If you live in New York, I'd love to invite you to my upcoming workshop on the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita is an ancient text that provides an explanation of our role in life and how we can find actual happiness right now. In contrast with our typical pursuits of happiness through external marks of success and wishing for things to change, the wisdom found in the Gita is like turning on a light in a room that we didn't realize was dark. It's a whole different perspective shift. Real happiness, or what in Sanskrit is called santosha, will flow when your actions are right and they're done from the right attitude. So in the workshop, I'll describe the story and we'll read a few excerpts. We'll develop a working, practical understanding of one of the main issues that's described, which is not being so attached to outcomes. And we'll learn about the different types of yoga. You may have never thought about it, but there are different types of yoga for different types of people. And I don't mean different type of asana, but a whole different outlook, a different way of thinking about how you live. So please come by. It's October 1st from 6:30 to 9 o'clock, and you can check it out at ishtayoga.com to register. Thanks a lot.
Your life is not fixed. It is never, I mean, this is, maybe shouldn't put this on the podcast.
I know,
it's never fixed, right? But it's anything.
Luckily, we can edit.
Yeah, edit that out. Meditation will cure everything.
Just takes a lot of time.
The monks had an average of 34,000 hours of meditation experience.
Wow. Yeah. But you know what?
Yes, right, exactly.
What I like, though, to remind students of, especially in the training, a lot of these meditation, besides the Buddhist monk meditation research, is they call it persistent meditators. We put persistent meditators into this 6-week mindfulness kind of protocol. And they kept saying the word persistent meditator. And then I looked up what their parameters were for persistent meditators. And it really was, there was a few different, but it was like someone that did it 5 minutes a day for 2 weeks. That was what they were calling persistent meditators, or sometimes, you know, 10 minutes a day. But it was a reasonable thing. It wasn't, you know,
thousands and thousands of hours.
The fact of, we talk a lot about parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system activation. The attempt alone at eliciting the parasympathetic response, even if you don't see Krishna, even if you don't have angels come and kiss you on the cheek during these practices, the attempt alone can be enough to have a shift in your nervous system. And that's great. So, you know, stay in Shavasana, stay in meditation, even if you're going through your grocery list, it's working still.
Exactly.
Yeah. Just keep at it.
Yeah, you know? And that's where I think telling people about the bitter pill, which is that, you know, it's life, and you're going to still be in your life, and there's still going to be all this stuff in your life, and that if you keep coming back and dipping your toe in that well, that it starts to shift. You know, everybody wants the, like, I think the sort of sudden, you know, illumination, and everything on the outside is going to suddenly be better, but it doesn't look like that. And there's no, I don't, for myself, I'm, like I said, I'm happy to quote the studies, but like, at the end of the day, you have to convince people to keep coming back. And I don't, I like to sort of say it up front, like, this is a way to approach this that has overall long-term and some short-term benefits, right? And you have to be willing to put the time and the effort in, because that's also part of yoga. I mean, that's
your question, like, how are you doing, is the only result that really matters to an individual. Like, I'm feeling X. Great. So, you know, notice how you're feeling today, and before you were having all of this, and look how much different you're reacting and things like that. And then that, it becomes...
You are the experiment.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
And for me, the person in the teacher role, the one who's sort of doing the getting people in that door and holding them there while they learn and doing all that stuff, like, that's, I feel like I need to learn about all those studies. I need to sit down and really figure out what I think about it. But I definitely don't need to give them a lot of, like, mental information about it. You know what I mean? Like, it's, I just want to give them the sugar, you know? And then I go, oh, that really, that, look at that progress happening. And then I can just kind of reflect that, like, this is what's happening here. Like, I can put it in that frame. So,
and so maybe, as something to look forward to at some point, the research could help us as teachers of meditation to be like, this person has this going on in their life, whether it's a health thing or an empathy thing or whatever. So based on some of the things I know research-wise, maybe there's a certain technique that this evidence base is saying might be the most effective, mm-hmm. right? Versus let me just do... you know, an open awareness meditation, that's not going to help me with my compassion.
And I think that is really one of the primary issues with the way that mindfulness is being applied in such a willy-nilly way right now. Yeah. You know, that, and it's one of the points that I tried to include in this book that Alan and I were writing, that meditation teachers understand what the practices do and what practices are good for what when something's mm-hmm. going on with a student. You know, we don't need to go, like, do research on a general population to figure mm-hmm. out that, you know, focusing on this thing is going to help you in what's going on with you, you know. And so I agree, it's like, for the kind of person who would respond better to data, yeah, that would be great. But also the experience of having taught a lot of people meditation is also, I think, good enough. It's like, you know, music teachers don't quote the scientific method when they're teaching somebody how to play the piano, you know? So there's that.
I think that's a really good analogy.
And I think it depends on where these practices are being applied to. Like, mm-hmm. there's such a push, at least, you know, of course, with yoga therapy, like, in order to make the practices more accessible to more people, let's get it more into the medical community.
Right.
And so if you're going to have maybe more people offering the techniques in those settings, you need that. Mm-hmm. All of this other information, mm-hmm. even to get it accepted.
Yeah, yeah.
This is going to be shocking coming from me.
Okay, Kristen, I'm sitting down.
We're ready.
Because I think I do tend to speak more from a science kind of, or I'm asked to speak a little bit more from a science perspective. But at a certain point, I don't think it matters one darn bit. I think, I know. I know. Please remove this from the podcast. I don't think it matters. I don't think, at a certain point, I don't think our job is to convince other people. It's to share what we know from our embodied experience and let them have the sugar. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much we need to be out there proselytizing and saying, here's the study and look, and it does this mm-hmm. in this group of 30 people in Sweden. And it, you know, it, at a certain point, I think our job is to just share what we know, live our lives, and let that life be kind of, this sounds a little hokey, but let that be the light in which people are then drawn to. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, this seems to be really working. You seem to be, you know, living with less suffering and more efficiency. Right. How do I get that? Yes. Okay, you sit every morning. Well, mm-hmm. let me try. You know, I think at a certain point, it almost does us a disservice of trying to justify an experience that at its best needs surrender more than intellectualizing.
Yeah.
You know, more chatter is going to just add to the mm-hmm. already full of noise brain we have.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I'm all for bringing it into schools or medical settings, and you need some studies to back it up. But I think the mindfulness is a beautiful practice. It gives you, TM is a beautiful practice. It gives you a dedication to sit, a reason to sit, a practice to do. That's discipline. These are all great. But then at a certain point, it's about surrender and the non-tangible right. qualities of meditation that you're never going to be able to study.
You yeah. can barely describe it.
You can't, yeah. yeah. It's once well, you put words to it, it becomes yeah. not really yeah. exactly it. So, yeah. you know, I'm all for just trying to get people to sit their butts down and do the practices. Yeah. But I have this like two minds about it a little bit of, is our job really to, you scream at the top of our lungs, like, do this practice, do yeah. this practice. But
well, I mean, I think some people have that role, like that yeah, is their karma, you know, and that's yeah. what they're trying to do. And that their work mm. is to do that. And so mm. I think that it's not necessarily the role of every teacher of meditation, yeah. mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I went to the conference last year, and I came away thinking, well, that was the science and yoga conference. And I came away thinking, well, that's really fascinating. And a lot of it was stuff that I definitely use as a teacher that I think about. But it's not for the lay person exactly. And I think, you know, for me, the issue really is like, okay, great. I totally want it in the schools. I totally want it in the jails. I want all the social workers to know, but I want it out there. But the problem is if you change it enough to make it fit in a box sometimes, and then you know, to get in the door, you get in the door with something that's not yoga.
Yeah.
And then what have you done? So there's somewhere in between, and I don't think we're anywhere near there yet. So, but I don't want it to be, I don't want yoga therapy to be, and this, I have a longstanding, I don't know what you would call it, argument. It's my own argument in my own head.
As all of ours are. I've got 12 going on right now.
Yeah. Good, we're in good company. Yeah. But this particular one has to do with like, how come yoga therapy got so narrowly defined so fast?
Yeah.
And is there a way to open that up? Because I consider what I do therapeutic 150% all the time, whether it's a studio class or it's a private session or it's, you know, whatever it is that I'm, whatever the format is, teaching, you know, in a group. But, you know, if you go to the yoga therapy, you know, IAYT, you can't say the word healing. You're not allowed.
Yeah.
So it's been, you know, so then I just decide, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm just going to give you the sugar. You can decide what it's doing. And
maybe
you know,
we should pick like fruit or something instead of sugar.
It seems I know, like it's funny, right?
We think getting sugar give you the sugar. I've got some
whatever brings them in. But I think it's a good point. I think it's about the application. So
yeah.
One of my teachers, Rod Stryker, says these practices are powerful.
Yeah.
The issue is If you come in insecure, they make you powerfully insecure.
Exactly.
If you come in arrogant, they make you powerfully arrogant. It's just adding, it's electricity. It's not discerning, mm-hmm. right? So it's whether your finger or a plug goes into that charge,
yeah.
it doesn't matter. It's gonna move, right?
Yeah.
And so it's the discerning of it. It's the how, what practices we're giving, how we're, the relationship between the teacher and student, yeah. these are the things that I think get stripped away when we try to make it such a appropriate for the business types that will not want to chant Om or talk about a chakra or even really do alternate nostril breath because it's too hippy-dippy, mm-hmm. right? So I think that's what I get concerned about is like you said, we're stripping away elements of it to make it acceptable. But in that, I think we're doing a disservice because people get aware of their minds in mindfulness. You get aware of how ridiculous and not to be trusted your own mind and emotions are.
Yes.
Then what?
Then what?
Yeah. Then what? You know, then right. you're stuck with that knowledge. Great. Good luck to you.
Awesome.
Awesome. Yeah. You know, yeah. You're going to go cuckoo. It's
right. And then the New York Times comes in and says, turns out yoga is bad for you. You know, it's funny. Yeah. I think somehow it must be partially that it's for us in the Western world, it's a new field, you know, a new, relatively speaking, because it feels like growing pains.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know? Because in most professions, like, you know, in the medical world, there's, you know, professional boards. You know, once something is board certified, there's somebody else that tells you if it's okay to do
meets
that.
The standards, yeah.
Well, mm-hmm. yoga's weird in terms of that scope of practice
right.
piece.
Yeah. yeah. Right. Very much so.
Yeah. Well, and it's very nature. The nature of yoga is to break us beyond all of the stuff we're talking about. You know, there's another piece of reality that yoga is designed to get to. And if you stop that anywhere along the way and are thinking about or researching or doing whatever, you're not going to that other place.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
when
you can't intellectualize yeah. yourself into meditation.
And when you go to that other place, when you've learned to do that through persistent practice over a long period of time
with supervision,
then you get from a teacher who understands who's been there, who's can help you do that,
yeah.
then you have experiences that transform you, that plug you into the electricity, mm-hmm. that let you change your life, transform you, and then the studies are irrelevant. You know, I mean, even the Bhagavad Gita says, you know, once you've experienced this, all of the writings are pointless. You don't need them, right? So I think that all of this is interesting, and at the same time it does encourage certain people to get intrigued, and so they want to do it. Podcasts stay afloat as labors of love, but they also need to pay the bills. Some do this through random ads. Others can get by as being infomercials for whatever's being talked about on the podcast. I'm hoping to support Peter's podcast, much like a pay-what-you-will yoga class. But there's no box at the front of the door here, so instead, I'm using the digital equivalent. That's why I'm asking you to please support Peter's podcast on patreon.com. Instead of a box, there's a link. It's easy, it's flexible if you want to vary your support, and most of all, it keeps this podcast going. Thank you to everyone who's already a podcast patron, and please check it out if you're not. Thank you. So I'd love to change the topic just a little bit to talk about maybe from the plus side, what are some of the things that are going on in research, in your own experiencing, in something, the way you talk about it, things you generally tend to share about meditation. to encourage students to do it. I know one thing, Wendy, maybe I can even start us off with this, is this whole vagal nervous system thing that you were pretty intrigued with last year, I think.
Well, I mean, it's sort of like the, it's sort of the, become the framework within which we, and not just yoga, but like a lot of different modalities have kind of gotten educated about. And I think, you know, like the understanding of it really ranges among practitioners and just people who are like, you know, that's, you know, your vagus is untoned. You got to tone it, you know,
like it's a bicep.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you define,
you know, that's good for your vagus nerve.
Can you define it for us or anybody?
Well, essentially, I mean, gosh, I feel like I'm, do you want to take that one, Kristen?
What is the vagus nerve?
Yeah, like, I mean, I'm happy to, but I just feel like I'm sitting across from the master.
So oh, definitely not a master. So you have a pair of cranial nerves that exit out through the bottom of the brain and down through the neck, and then there's a pair of them, but they're called the vagus nerve.
Wendy, you know this is a podcast, right?
She's over here
demonstrating.
Oh, yeah. Can they not see us? and it comes from a root word like vagabond, or word vagabond. So it means the wanderer. So it wanders down through the body and hits almost every organ in the thorax and the abdominal
region.
Still demonstrating. Yeah, very nice.
I'm getting helped by it. Thank you.
And it has both sympathetic and parasympathetic fibers, but it's known to be a big output of the parasympathetic part of our nervous system. And this idea of increasing our vagal tone, there's something called cardiac sympathetic, cardiac sinus arrhythmia, that every time you inhale, your heartbeat speeds up a bit. Every time you exhale, your heartbeat slows down a little bit. So if you take those numbers, how fast it goes and how slow it goes, minus, you come up with a number. That's called your vagal tone, right? How responsive you are to stress and relaxation, right? So
using inhale as a indicator of stress.
Using these numbers, yeah. The inhale, it stimulates something called the cardiac sympathetic nerve, which revs your heart up. On exhale, it stimulates something called the vagus nerve, which slows your heartbeat down.
Is that heart rate variability?
Yeah, okay. Heart rate variability.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the term I've heard.
Also called sinus arrhythmia. Yeah. So if they put you on an EKG machine and they're looking at your heartbeat, right, it has different waves, different rhythms. So they're measuring kind of the difference between those two numbers. Those that have reported higher vagal tone, so a larger difference between those two numbers, report to be happier, more content, deal with stress better. They have less of those precursors to disease, like higher cholesterol, higher BP, less obesity. They report having better relationships, less lonely, less incidence of depression.
Better taste in food. And all
yeah, they're just generally
They're just
better.
Generally cooler people.
So there's a lot of variability in Williamsburg. Huh?
Stop it.
Those that have a lower vagal tone seem to have the opposite, higher rates of obesity, heart disease, stroke, cardiovascular issues, report to be more lonely, deal with stress poorly, not as optimistic.
Yeah.
So these things are, and so
is there a speed component with that too? Like how fast and slow, like the beat rate is like not consistent?
It's more the difference
okay.
between the variability. But I think all the practices that we're doing, asana, pranayama, meditation, everything you can think of in the big yoga umbrella, are really tapping into this. You know, we do different we inhale longer than the exhale, or we exhale longer than the inhale, or we hold our breath, or we do these different meditation techniques. All of them are kind of hacking into this variability.
I agree.
You know, and I think that's the big buzzword is vagal tone or heart rate variability and Heart Math Institute. You know, all of these things are the big thing over the last 5 years.
Yeah.
But these practices are all tapping into that same thing.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like for a long time, it was like the parasympathetic system is good and the sympathetic system is bad. I mean, once yoga got involved, it was like, you need to get into your parasympathetic.
No, once yoga people got involved, yoga it's not people. The yoga.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, in this contemporary moment, like say over the last number of years.
Right, it's all about relax.
And relax.
Let go.
And what got a little bit lost that for me got brought back by Stephen Porges a little bit and the people who paid attention to him is this idea that it's absolutely reflected in the biology that you're talking about is the idea not that it's good to relax or bad to have stress, but that health exists in the ability to switch between them.
Yes.
And so that variability shows that because if you're stressing your heart by inhaling, which doesn't seem like it would be that stressful, but you know.
But stress is a good word.
It's a good word.
Stress in anatomy is actually a word meaning it's
activates.
How we evolve.
Exactly.
Right? It's how our bones regenerate. It's how our cells are told to regenerate. It is by stress.
You have to give it something to work
to
on.
Stress yes. them.
To stress yeah. them.
And so, you know, the idea is how quickly do you recover from that? And
or your relationship to it.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, right. Isn't that's the so amazing? Like I think it's probably from in those studies. I read a story about if you, and this is all about PTSD and trauma too. If a soldier who's prepared for war gets shot in the war, the recovery incidence, the recovery rate, the ability to recover is greatly enhanced over the same wound received at night in an alley. Like in a hold up, same gunshot wound. That person will have a much harder time recovering because the shock is so much more, and the I think the variability of all of the systems to sort of come in and get on board with the stress that's happened, and I just think that so relates to yoga. You know, we're being trained to allow our systems to be able to shift in all these different circumstances when it's not a crisis. And then when there's something to really, that's really a crisis or whatever, a real stress out in the world, we deal with it.
Yeah, I never understood why sympathetic part of our nervous system was so demonized.
I know.
You know, we're meant to be on it every 1 to 4 hours. We shift back and forth between sympathetic and parasympathetic.
Yeah.
So why would half of our day be an error?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Why would, we're all on sympathetic right now to have a conversation, to listen, but also think of our, you know, question that we're going to ask to, you know, take care of all the audio equipment. Like we have to be on sympathetic. This is how we.
It's life.
It is life.
Yeah.
It is our relationship to sympathetic and parasympathetic that we are becoming more masterful of.
For sure.
There's nothing about us that we need to quash, quell, stuff away, ignore, resist.
It is
befriending both and having access to both and learning how through these techniques, when one is elicited and it's not going to be our friend right now, how to get in the other part of ourself, you know.
Well, don't you think that the real issue becomes around the, you know, I don't know that we need to label it PTSD, but when the dysfunction happens, like when the pattern doesn't get, you know, if
resilience.
Something happens that the resiliency is lost, then that's sympathetic or it can be parasympathic. I mean, you know, but whatever.
I mean, I think,
gets dissociated,
and I think that's one of the things, like I started this saying, you know, like, what are the things you're thinking about? I mean, in the trauma world, that resiliency is a big piece of what they're thinking about, that there will be something that triggers you because even anybody gets triggered by stuff, yeah. right? But the ability to come back from that
exactly.
is something that can
be
fostered.
Retrained.
Right, that can be fostered through meditative practice
yeah.
as part of
through meditation.
Practice.
And that's why, I mean, that is really why I feel like it's important to spend so much time processing with people, because they might have a triggered response to the practice that you gave them. And that doesn't mean it's a bad practice or that they're like not a good student, but you know, maybe it's not the right practice, or maybe they just need that intervention because their nervous system needs to retrain to the new way, and they just need to have that. It's almost like, you know, having a new experience in the face of the old experience starts to change the way that the sympathetic and parasympathetic relate to each other. You
yeah.
know, like they could, if they come in contact with the thing that was triggering and they get stuck in that sympathetic response, then if you can bring them through that technique or that moment in a new way, it actually changes the way they experience the trigger somehow. It creates the new resiliency.
It's neuroplastic. So, right. And you start to build a new path.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny.
Yeah. I think that it's slightly off topic, forgive me, but it reminds me, though, it's a good idea to tell students when they're processing after mm-hmm. these meditations that I hear so often, and I forget now,
yeah.
That people think it's about quieting their mind, or stilling
the
mind.
This is my whole job.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's not going to do it.
Right. You know, I have a friend who's dipping a toe into the meditation. He knows it's going to be good for him. He knows that he sees it's, and I, you know, exclaim that it's been good for me. And he said, well, I tried it, but I'm no good at it because mm-hmm. All I was doing was thinking. So it's not for me, apparently. And I'm like, who is telling people that it's about, like, I have meditations where I'm just still 26, 7 years later. I think of my grocery list the whole time. I cry over something that has no relevance really in my life. You know, like there's all sorts of experiences in meditations. There are times where there's a pause, a lovely God-given pause that happens. But a lot of times it's a lot of noise with intermittent pauses and
right.
more noise and some right. emotion and then some boredom and then a leg that falls asleep. And I feel like during those processing with our teacher training students or friends, loved ones that are doing it, that's an experience.
Exactly.
Yes.
Right. And also I really teach people to look for the shift. Not necessarily looking for, the quiet mind, but like, were you obsessing on a thing and then suddenly you weren't? Do you know what I mean? What's the shift? It could be emotional body. It could be physical body. Often it's breath. Like, you know, you'll notice if you're paying attention, you know, that you'll take a sigh or you'll twitch and, you know, something. Well, it can be so many different things, but I really do try and point that out so that they start to get a new idea about what they're there for.
Also, cumulative, you know, a week later, how do you feel in your relationships?
Right.
A month later,
right.
has anything shifted in your relationships?
Right.
Exactly.
You know, a year later, is
exactly.
it easier for you just to commit to sitting no matter what?
Yeah.
You know, these are changes that are...
Exactly. And, you know, people who... This is why it's hard. We go back to that same discussion about how do you bring people in the door is a different discussion than how do you keep people in the room. Because, you know, you only really get to have those conversations with people who have committed to a training or come see you privately, or, you know what I mean? There's an ongoing relationship. Whereas, you know, if you're trying to, I don't know, convince somebody of something to have one experience,
well, that's why
harder.
I'm not sure if that's our job anymore.
Yeah.
I just read something with Mark Whitwell that he was kind of making the claim, like, it's not our job to, like, get people to come in or advertise this whole thing. And part of me resists that because, gosh, I want to share it with everyone. And mm-hmm. and part of our jobs and our livelihood mm-hmm. depends sure. on people coming to these
our
things.
Jobs.
Like, yeah, our actual. my landlord's not going to really appreciate yeah. it. It's like, oh, it's not really my. Yeah, yeah. It's not my time to share. It is my literal job to share these yeah. things, but it really did kind of make me think, like, my job is just to show up, meet people where they are, share from my experience. If they latch onto it, maybe there's some karmic thing, it's not their time, or maybe I'm incorrect or on the wrong path as well, who knows, you know? So it's just, maybe our job is just to yeah. have our own practice of it
yeah.
and let that be...
Speak for itself.
Speak for
yes,
itself.
Yes.
I agree. I do.
Kelly,
I mean,
Kelly, do you have a thing that you use as a go-to when you're like preaching? Since we just said we don't preach and we shouldn't be preaching, well, I think we all.
I said
do
that,
preach.
And then I just preached for about 45 minutes before I said that. So, you know.
Well, I think it depends on the context, but often, at least in terms of working with private clients. Everyone comes in with, not everyone, but many folks come in with the things that they're struggling with. And so I sometimes just reflect back, like, on what I'm hearing. And, you know, should we try to meditate just to see, right, if there's a shift?
Yeah. Sneaky.
You know.
Or I call if changing the energy.
If it relates to, like, I'm feeling so stressed, and then I'm like, well, you know, there's been pretty good data on that meditation can help with stress,
mm-hmm.
right? So even mm-hmm. we don't have to worry about trying to get your mind still or whatever. We can try these practices and see how you feel. Mm-hmm. Is it going to help on that level? And usually interesting things happen.
Mm-hmm.
But the conversation that was just happening brings me to a question on what is, and this is maybe off topic, what is a yoga teacher's role in helping people process their meditative experiences and especially challenging ones? Because that's always
We've
a place
had this conversation a couple of times.
Where I feel I want to send you right to an authority, you know
yeah.
what I mean?
You mean like the psychology kind of question?
Yeah, like I'm maybe going like, yeah, beyond my scope, beyond my training. I don't, you know, I don't want to.
It's like when people come into asana class and show you the boil on their knee.
Yeah.
I have this book right here, a couple of us brought books. This is called The Perennial Psychology of the Bhagavad Gita, and it's by Swami Rama. And he sat down with a therapist, but so far I've read 138 pages, and it's basically all yoga. And, you know, I think that as yoga teachers, you know, one of the things Mark Whitwell said is if you want to teach, you just have to practice yoga and want to help people.
Right,
you know?
And help exactly.
And if you have a... And have a teacher. Those first two are the things that I think will, this teacher keeps you honest, right?
Well, yeah.
And when you encounter someone who's your student, because you've met those three criteria, and they've found you and they resonate with the energy of you because you're glowing, however, from mm-hmm. your practice, I think you have to trust your own capabilities, you know, that you'll say the thing that is flowing through you because you're in the right relationship, meaning you're here for the right reason. You're right. Here as a vessel.
And you can go, as the teacher, you can go to another teacher or your teacher or somebody else, because often what's happening there is you're getting triggered. So you're reflecting and then you get triggered, and because it has to be safe, right? So a lot of the stuff of what I know about this part of it comes out of my polarity training, where it's years of that, of training in you know, that interactive place. But even without that, you know, we all need, that's why I said teacher, right? Because you need to go to somebody outside of that interaction who can hold this mirror up for you. And then once you see it, like, you don't need to send your clients to an expert. You just need to get that expert space holding for you to get clear on what it did, like, why did I, so like, five people can come in and people are in their process and they're doing their thing and I'm fine with it. And then this one person came in and it was like, oh my God, I need to get some help. They need to get other help than me. It's, you know, it's, I just think that that's a really important thing for yoga teachers to know that, you know, we're in there with our lower self and our higher self. You know, we're in there with our own triggers. Yoga, it's not about getting rid of all your triggers so that you can go in the room and help people get resilient, right? It's about, I've learned how to do the management of my own, I've learned how to become resilient myself. It's the same thing as saying, like, you know, that's how, why my life looks good to you, you know, because I'm moving through this. And so if you, and there's nothing wrong with saying, you know, this is probably a diagnosable thing. I can send them to the, I like having a Rolodex, you know, just like everybody else. But I think the, you know, it's a little bit like the nervous systems themselves, you know, like if the sympathetic system fails, then we go to the, you know, if the social nervous system and then the sympathetic and then the parasympathetic, you know, like it's a process, you know, people need to be led through that. And in a way, so do we need to learn how to go through those processes with ourselves.
Yes, and
yes.
I also think it's important to realize our scope and that there are times where they need, well, I think almost everyone could benefit from a little therapy, you know, and there are times where it's a meditation will get you so far and you hit a block of something that meditation will not take you through, that you need chemical help.
That's
of
true.
of
absolutely,
that a psychiatrist can offer, a therapy help, a trained social worker, psychotherapist, some kind of therapist, that's beyond my scope as a teacher. And then when there's a team of people, I can also send them there, and then also support their work with their therapist with meditation or with some kind of yoga practice. But I think it's also important that we don't say meditation can heal and fix, and no, it's just, you know, stay with me, your teacher, because I will bring you I think that becomes dangerous. I think we have to know the limits of what we as human being yoga teachers offer people. At least that's my feeling. I don't feel comfortable.
Other training, you know, the other training that I have is bleeding into what I feel like I can handle. But there's an issue about safety. That's the main issue. And if, you know, what I generally think is important is to get educated around what feels safe for you as a teacher, right? That if you are not feeling safe, then you need to do the work of realizing that you're outside of your scope and or get some help, right? There's definite decision to be made there.
Yeah, and I just want to go back, because I said trust yourself, and I think part of trusting yourself is to know that there's a whole lot more in us than we usually go with, unless you build that kind of trust. In other words, you know, I know certain yoga teachers who would feel very confident in counseling someone on a whole wide range of things. But there's also the point where you go, you know, I'm very confident that you need to talk to a therapist about this issue, right? And that's a part of being confident too, to be able to say, well, I'm not, it's different from saying, oh, I don't feel like I know anything about this. It's more like, I know what I know, and what I know now is that you need this other thing. And that, I think, also comes through when you're in the right space.
I think so, too. I mean, I you know, where I come down in it is I think that yoga teachers need more training in that area.
Yes.
And
definitely.
That then they would be more educated about when their clients need to go to see a therapist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, but that to just sort of say, oh, it's out of my scope, feels like a to me, because of how I work, it doesn't feel complete. You know, I think that there's a lot of gray area around healthy people with moderate issues arising from their efforts in meditation that can be dealt with in-house, kind of, you know. And then how do you recognize when somebody's really got an issue that you're not able to deal with?
Right.
Sure.
And how do you, and what are the, it's a little bit like recognizing, you know, when somebody needs more props or this class isn't right for them, or, yeah, you know what I mean?
It's just. Yeah. But yeah. And, but you brought up something really, I think, important, which is it's okay to be unhappy. You know, when yeah, we have someone who's practicing and they tap into something during meditation and it makes them sad or they feel like X, you know, it's okay to just hold space for that feeling.
Yeah.
And to know that, yeah, you know, that's true. That happened to you. That's sad, you know, and now we're here and this is where we are and that was there, you know. And so it's like, yeah, providing perspective also. And then, of course, there are really challenging issues or yeah, illnesses and things like that. That's a different
issue. I
think
it comes up in all the regular yoga classes.
Everything.
Too. Like,
yeah,
you know, anytime you put people in, you know, a restorative pose and they start crying and you teach the room, like, it's okay to have an emotional reaction. It's part of the process. You're doing it. You know, it's just sometimes, you know, like if that person is coming to cry incessantly in your class and they're, you know, you're like, it's kind of like being on the front lines, you know? Mm-hmm. So then how do you?
Yeah.
Well, what I worry though about in the way yoga is often practiced in New York City in 2019,
yes,
is that people are dropping in, having experiences, doing techniques, having experiences, meeting themselves, having that experience, and then there's no follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
And so, or it's infrequent.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have an underlying condition of manic or bipolar, depression, major depressive episodes, psychosis, you know, or just an overwhelming tsunami of emotions that you're now meeting for the very first time where you hadn't in 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Not speaking for anyone. you know, then what? If you don't have a regular practice, if you don't have a regular teacher.
Well, perhaps that's the biggest takeaway from this, is that
yeah,
that persistence of practice, and it doesn't just mean 2 weeks for 5 minutes. It's
yeah,
like an ongoing commitment to be
with a sangha, with a group.
Yeah,
I don't
sure
think
yes
it can be done alone.
Yes.
You need the support and the community of it, and of going like, is this happening for you? My
yeah
God, when I'm in this meditation,
yeah,
holy cow, yeah, like, what is this? And you need a way, an ability, a way to share that and process it
and get guidance
and move it, you know.
There is someone doing research on adverse effects of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
It's at Brown University. Do you know of this? Willoughby
of
Britton,
yeah,
I think.
There's a guy who published a book a year ago, I think, that was trying to debunk the mindfulness thing,
mm-hmm,
you know, and saying how many people have adverse reactions, to which I say, well, of course, if you're not looking at a wide range of practice and who are your students and what do they need, of course there are going to be adverse reactions.
Well, we also just identified a little bit of something about that, which is that adverse reactions are expected at a certain level.
Yeah.
Right?
As a
like
part of growth.
How to move them.
But it's yeah how
you're
to,
meeting your mind,
yes,
you're meeting your emotions. It's not all
it's
peace and love and
no
kissing
right
kittens in there.
Right.
Exactly.
It's
which
tumultuous.
Is why
and
I like to say the bitter pill right up front.
Yeah.
You know, like this is an ongoing process. If you're serious about it, or if you're intrigued about it, you know, don't expect it to be, you know, as Al would say, ducks and geese, because that's not what this is about. And then if, you know, 5 of the 10 people leave the room, I think, okay, phew, let's get to work. You know, but that's just me. And I, you know, that's why I live deep in Brooklyn in a one-bedroom apartment.
Wow.
Sorry. It's a lovely apartment.
Thank you.
You can edit that
we
out.
We like it. Yeah, well, we do have to wrap up, but I think that it's coming in and not knowing what the heck we were going to talk about. I think we sure talked about a lot of stuff, and I think it was pretty interesting. So thank you so much for doing this, and I look forward to talking again.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks. Yeah,
thank you,
namaste.
Peter.
Namaste.
Thank you, guys. Namaste. Namaste.
Imagine a paradise of palm trees, rice paddies, beautiful people, beautiful colors, wonderful weather in the middle of February, and yoga to boot. That's the retreat in Bali, February 2020, led by Aino Sirin and myself, with special guest Wendy Newton, February 8 through 15. Check out the show notes for a link, or see peterfurco.com for more information. Can't wait to go. Can't wait to see you there. Bali. That's today's episode. Thanks a lot for listening to Peter's podcast. I hope that you find real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living through your practice. Please support me on Patreon, rate the podcast, and I'll see you next week. Namaste.